problem was too many people are working, or working people are working, making too much money. That's not the problem.
So I reckon I get this one. The problem is too many people are working. Working people are working, and working people are getting too much money. But in the 6 seconds it took Sleepy Joe to say that, it stopped being the problem and it became not the problem. So it isn't the problem. Why don't we, instead of worrying about what the problem is, get on with episode 327 of English History, Fact and Fiction. The story this week will be about Charlotte. Let's get on with it. It's music there from the TV show that is dedicated to this very Queen Charlotte. Where we left it was that it was going well in England. George has employed some people to be on Charlotte's staff. That's nice. That Colonel Graham will be her secretary. He's a former Jacobite and he'll be told, "Colonel Graham, I congratulate you on exchanging the dangerous employment of making kings for the more lucrative one of making queens." But he had been kind to Charlotte in Germany and befriended her. "We've got plenty of sparkly jewels out for Charlotte, and a suite in St. James has been renovated for the marriage ceremony. It's all going swimmingly well," until George was told that Charlotte was also bringing her German hairdresser with her. "The orders have been specific. Two women only, Charlotte, not two women and a bloody hairdresser. What bit about two did you not understand?" George will relent and he will allow the hairdresser to come in. Frederick Albert Papen Dick will be a page boy / hairdresser. George will micromanage the whole deal, from sending Harcourt to receipt of Charlotte. Charlotte will have zero say in the whole thing. She'll have no say in the handing out of jobs. All jobs will be handed out by George. All 12 ladies in waiting will be selected by George. Even the dropping of her Sophie Charlotte to just Charlotte was a decision that was just made for her. Charlotte is considered a queen's name. Sophie Charlotte? Nah. All done before she'd even left Germany. Her moving through Germany, of course, was a big hairy deal. Our teenager has gone from a nobody to the centre of attention overnight. There were, of course, storms. Charlotte will not be seasick, but will practice English with her new English ladies. Attempts to land at Greenwich are abandoned, and the royal yacht will safely get to Harwich. Urgent message to George, your Queen's here. The coronation of the 22nd of September will have a king and queen. Isn't that nice? George is very happy. Charlotte, meantime, is in the house of the Earl of Alcorn, where she will find out that royals are expected to eat in full sight of whoever wants to watch them eat. Oh, I don't think she likes that much. Oh well, she'll get used to it. Next day, the king's coach is here to transport Charlotte to London. The crowds are out to cheer and wave. One dickhead will put his hand on the window of the coach and jump up. Those fingers will be whacked with a guard's sword. Yeah, he won't be doing that again. Charlotte will tell the driver to slow down so she can do waving back to the mob, and they can have time to have a good look at her. Then she goes to St. James's Palace. The Duke of Devonshire will help her out of the coach, and her intended brother-in-law, the Duke of York, will catch her when she has a little stumble. Here comes George, though, and Charlotte will throw herself at his feet, but he will raise her up and give her a hug and lead her into the place. Charlotte will offer George her snuff box. George will say, "Oh, I never touched the stuff." So Charlotte will give her snuff box away. A few days later, and here is George with his and hers snuff boxes of magnificence. Is this true love? Snuff box gifts? It could be. But hang on, we've only got 6 hours or something before the bloody wedding. So meet the family, here's your 10 bridesmaids, and yes, you're expected to remember all the names. Poor Charlotte has to wear a big, heavy dress, an English thing that George kind of picked, and plenty of bling. Charlotte will be impressed with the bling and develop a bit of an obsession with the stuff. Especially though, she will say, putting them on is too much trouble, and owning them means you're always stressed that you're going to lose something. And the care that they require just isn't worthwhile to have the bloody things. As for Fox, she'd just like a plain old comfy dress, thank you. Nobody will believe her, and she will school some magnificent diamonds from that Indian chappy, the Nabob. Here comes the bride into a room full of people, and it's a wardrobe malfunction. Oh, the gemstones were all pretty heavy, and the top of a frock got dragged halfway down to her waist. That's not what you need when you're the new girl, is it? George's family, though, will be supportive and get Charlotte through the whole thing. Charlotte will start to relax and even knock out a tune on the harpsichord, singing along herself. She will chat with the guests and will need to be told by George, hey kiddo, time for bed. Charlotte had heard about the bedding ceremony and requested that perhaps we could skip that bit with all the people coming in for a good gawk. George will agree, and that is it for that particular bit of bullshit. Never again for the British Royals. Next day, and the royal couple can host their first drawing room. Elderly Lord Westmoreland will come in and kneel to Lady Sarah Lennox. She'll put him right. She'll say, no, you've got the wrong woman, mate. Charlotte doesn't care. She's the one who George married, and George is looking a bit smitten with her. This thing seems to be working. Charlotte is happy to stay out of politics and be the one who makes home a happy place. George had warned her to be suspicious of anyone looking for her favour, and she will be just that. Charlotte can get the good news that she gets an independent income of £40,000 a year. Her entire family, you might recall, was getting by on £15,000 a year. If George dies first, she'll be on $100,000 a year and score Somerset House and Richmond Old Park. She's hit the jackpot. Getting to silly hat time, and here's a blast from the past. It's Henrietta Howard, well-known woman stylist who was called in to sort out Charlotte's frock and whatever. A nice, trustworthy woman to help out the teen queen. Lovely. Henrietta can explain the ceremony to her. London is in a frenzy for the silly beheading, because we've got a new young king and queen. We like it when they're young, don't we? People are camping out along the route. Grandstands are full. Soldiers are on duty to keep the crowd in check. Charlotte is having a fit of nerves. She's come up with a plan, though. Put Frederick Albert Pappendick, hairdresser to the stars, in a place where she can see him. If she just keeps looking at Frederick, everything should work out. Poor Charlotte has to wear the bloody wedding frock again, the big old heavy thing. Well, let's hope it doesn't fall down again. She's going to have hair extensions for this one. Charlotte will be off down the coronation route with Princess Augusta. That's a sister-in-law, not a mother-in-law. These two girls will not get on. Augusta thought that Charlotte wanted more cash, which doesn't seem to be right, and Charlotte thought that Augusta was a big fat gossip, which does actually look to be right. Still, no wardrobe malfunction, so there is that, and we can move on to the feast. George had made Charlotte the guest of honour. That's lovely, isn't it? As Charlotte walked in, the special effects team wanted 3,000 candles to suddenly light up. How you do this is with flax wicks, so off we go with just a small problem that bits of the burning flax will drop down onto the guests. Oh, shit. Then it's the feast, which is a bit plain, but that is the preference for our new king and queen. Humble fare over opulence. Doesn't matter, because Charlotte, it seems, is naturally charming. People love her, except for Augusta, and now the other Augusta, mother-in-law. Older Augusta thinks that Charlotte has too much influence over her lad, George. Of course, bloody old mother-in-laws. And so we get to some unhappiness for Charlotte. George is a frequent flyer to see his mum and Bute, and the three of them will be talking business. Charlotte isn't welcome, so a 17-year-old will find herself in a palace with no authorisation to go out. In fact, George is into a bit of control over Charlotte. He liked her youth and lack of ambition, and he wants those two things to never change. Charlotte, though, will get out and go to the theatre and opera as often as she can. She can also take nice walks through the royal parks and continue her philanthropy. It's going to take her quite a few years to invent the Christmas tree, but we know that the first one had sweetmeats hanging off it and toys, and it was all nicely lit up with lots of candles. Charlotte brought in 64 families who got a dinner described as substantial. The kiddies all then got to walk around the tree and get some sweetmeats plus a toy. Charlotte's Santa, isn't she? As for the tree, it was a yew tree, just in case you're wondering. Young Charlotte, though, won't take long at all to have her philanthropic outgoings exceeding £5,000 a year. She wasn't into bagging those fallen women, funding housing and education for them. She also established an orphanage for young ladies who might be at risk of sexploitation. Another fund was established to help 50 orphan girls from army types and 50 orphan girls from navy types. Charlotte took then a personal interest in the girls' welfare. Just her patronage helped institutions like different hospitals to flourish. Charlotte was not that fond of being in public, but will hit on an idea to raise more funds. The Queen Charlotte Annual Ball, which is where the debutantes are presented to her. Yeah, I think it's that Bridget and stuff, isn't it? It will help fund the Queen Charlotte's and Chelsea Hospital. But we haven't had George's wedding gift to Charlotte yet. That would be because it took quite a bit of time to turn up. Let's see, can you guess? Did you guess a zebra? If so, correct. It's a zebra. Well, she will also get Buckingham House as a present, and yeah, it's still called Buckingham House, but it'll be called Buckingham Palace soon, and it will be Charlotte's even if she has to give up Somerset House for it. But she really likes the place. Back to the zebra, and we want to see those things drawing the royal coaches. This zebra, though, is particularly grumpy, with lots of biting and kicking, and getting rid of any wannabe zebra tamers. While all this giving to the poor was going on out in the public, behind the doors, George and Charlotte were rather thrifty. George was particularly happy with Charlotte being resourceful and not spending. He even said it out loud. The Queen will maintain 6 daughters for less than 4 were 49 years ago, when every article of life was cheaper than now. Yet Charlotte had learned her lessons on home management well. It's domestic bliss, so of course it's about to go all horribly wrong. George was delighted with Charlotte. She is young, inexperienced, and willing to go along with whatever George says. He will personally vet who can attend her drawing rooms. On top of that, she has Madame Schwellenberg also controlling access. Both George and Madame want to control her and keep her compliant. George wants it all nice and simple. He will even forego the royal mistress. Too complicated for George. I wouldn't have thought so, but there you go. Charlotte will then pick up that George mistrusts anyone who wants that royal favour and herself mistrusts anyone who wants her favour. Charlotte then is not acting like the queens we've been seeing. She's just doing the stand-by-your-man routine, and the happy couple will spoil each other. Charlotte will be up the spout nice and fast, and that is when George will gift-wrap Buckingham House for her. Now, I'm kidding on the gift-wrap, but it will be known as the Queen's House for a while now. Charlotte can relax in her favourite room, the Green Room. George can be nearby at his hobby, which is bookbinding. They have an impressive library. Summers will be spent at Richmond or Kew or Windsor, where Charlotte will be remodelling the gardens, but George and Charlotte will continue to lead quiet, inexpensive lives full of domestic bliss. Parties are invite only. George and Charlotte want to avoid the common smellies who are happy to vocalise their discontent at all the unhappy stuff going on. George and Charlotte will hide themselves away at every opportunity. Back to Charlotte, being up the spout, and George will have a sudden fever. It's influenza, and George will recover. But it was tense there for a bit, where it looked like we would have a pregnant queen, but no king and no heir. 12th of August, 1762, and being a week late, Charlotte will go into labour. Dr. William Hunter will decide to be on standby, leaving the works of the midwife. Good plan, mate. Big swinging dicks are also, of course, on standby ready for the royal berth. 7 a.m, boy, fire the cannon. Earl of Huntingdon will be on the road to let George know he's a dad. Nice timing, because just a short time later, a procession will pass Charlotte's window, carrying a captured treasure from the Spanish ship Hermione. Marvellous. Okay, let's turn to the, well, it's not really a gossip magazine, I guess it's a newspaper, isn't it? The prince is born Duke of Cornwall, and according to custom, will, we suppose, soon be created Prince of Wales and Earl of Chester. It is something remarkable that His Royal Highness was born on the anniversary of his illustrious family's ascension to the imperial throne of these kingdoms, and about the hour of the day on which that succession took place. Marvellous, and welcome to the world, George Augustus, who will be better known as the Prince Regent. Well, certainly as the Prince Regent, but also as Charlotte's treasure. George and Charlotte are besotted with their firstborn, and Charlotte will even want to breastfeed the little chap. But she isn't well enough. Here's Mrs. Scott, who's got a dozen or so kiddies, and her titties are full of mother's milk. Charlotte has cracked an heir to the big chair on her first go, and George will spoil her even more. No buggering around, and before you know it, we have spare heir Fred, Duke of York, then Willie, Duke of Clarence. Marvellous stuff, and bring on Lady Charlotte Finch to look after little buggers. Both George and Charlotte had parents who had taken hands-on roles in their upbringing, and so they will be the same and be rather involved with the kiddies. Charlotte will insist that the kiddies are inoculated against smallpox. Or variolated, really. Variolated means to be inoculated against smallpox, but using the smallpox material. Once our sciencey types start manufacturing smallpox vaccine, we will just inoculate. Why am I saying all this? I don't know. George will be a fun-loving parent, while Charlotte will do the discipline when needed. But she can do the fun stuff, even if it doesn't always work. 1769, anniversary of George getting the silly hat. She will dress up the kiddies as statespeople for a bit of fun. The Whig newspapers will totally bag Charlotte for it. She was mocking the dignity of the royal family. Yeah, fun's not allowed, Charlotte. Fuck everybody else, we can be like Katrina and the waves, walking on sunshine, if we want. 1765, and a contented Charlotte is well and truly up the spout with kiddie number 3 when George gets ill again. In comes Princess Augusta and Bute, ready to run the show. Charlotte, you just run along now, and don't worry your pretty little head about a thing. We'll take care of everything, including George, but Charlotte ain't having it. She will be sitting by her man. She'll be looking after him. Word is out about a power struggle, and Augusta is even less popular than before. Madame Schwellenberg will be strongly recommending to Charlotte that she confront Augusta and Bute. But that's not Charlotte's style. She's not into confrontation. She just wants to sit with George. George will recover, but we can all see the strain is having an effect. He is constantly at odds with Parliament, the Americans are constantly looking a bit revolting, and it's time to think about a Regency Bill to cover the place if George gets crook again. The talk is how bad it would be if Augusta became regent and how great it would be if Charlotte became regent. Charlotte has no desire at all to be a regent. Meanwhile, Augusta is totally shitty with Madame Schwellenberg and wants Charlotte to give her the boot. Madame Schwellenberg, on the other hand, is recommending strongly to Charlotte that she stand up to her mother-in-law. Charlotte, though, is just willing to stand by her man. That's all she wants to do. As soon as George starts to recover, Augusta is in there demanding Madame Schwellenberg be sent back to Germany. George is okay with that, but some Charlotte boo-boo-hooing will keep Madame Schwellenberg with her in England. Now, Charlotte is George's biggest fan and champion, and he surely needs one with all that American unhappiness and Irish unhappiness and, well, there's a bit of English unhappiness as well. 1766, Kitty number 4, Charlotte. 1767, Kitty number 5, Edward. 1768, Kitty number 6, Augusta Sophia. Oh, my giddy out. 1769, and Charlotte can have a break. 1770, Kitty number 7, Elizabeth. Oh, only 8 more to go. On the minor side, there goes George's brother, Edward, Duke of York, in 1767. He's just 28 years old. Not sure what killed him, but he died in Monaco. And 3 years later, Jimmy Cook will name Cape York Peninsula in far north Queensland for this guy, this particular Duke of York. Yeah. Even though the indigenous people have been there for about 60,000 years, yeah, who cares about them? They don't count. Nor did the Dutch sailor Willem Janszoon, who landed there in 1606, count. He got there 161 years before Captain Jimbo Cook. But we don't count him, no, because we want to be English descended. But the next year, 1768, George will lose a sister, Louisa, 19. She'd been sickly for her rather short life. Prince Christian of Denmark was sniffing around, but when the Danes saw her, they said, oh, yeah, yeah. Have you got a healthier-looking one? Oh, Caroline Matilda. Yeah, she looks pretty healthy. We'll have her. Then Charlotte's brother, Adolf Fred, proposed, but the English said, yeah, perhaps you should just wait a bit longer and see if she's going to live. Well, she didn't live. She died. 1769, and George's brother, Prince Henry, Duke of Cumberland. Don't panic. It's not dead. No, it's worse. It's worse than death. It's scandal. It's scandal at a time when we're really ramping up our societal whatever bullshit. Like, we had all the magical bullshit with the churches, and now we've got all this societal fucking bullshit. Everything's got to be proper. I would have gone totally insane living in these times. There had been an allegation that Prince Henry, Duke of Cumberland, had secretly married a common smelly, one Olive Wilmot, and that the couple had a kitty. We won't worry about that one, because it turned out that Olive Wilmot forged evidence that she presented. But then there was his mistress, Anne Elliot, actress, who died aged 25 in a house he'd set up for her. But I suppose we're not worried about that one either, because Anne was a mistress and she's long-term sickly. No, the scandal is he is being sued by Lord Grosvenor for criminal conversation. That is adultery, criminal conversation. Naughty Henry had been found in the arms of Lady Grosvenor. Lord Grosvenor will be awarded £13,000 and all out, that stings. All nice and fair and just and bullshit, because Lord Grosvenor was well known to be banging prostitutes himself, so nothing wrong with banging prostitutes, that's not adultery or criminal conversation. No, no adultery to be seen until you find your missus doing it. But this is a horror show for George and Charlotte, a royal couple involved in scandal. Oh no! Henry hasn't finished being naughty, though. In a couple of years, he will marry a common smelly, a widow, Anne Horton, and that will have Henry banished. Worse, of course it's worse. Another brother, William Henry, Duke of Gloucester, will also marry a common smelly, Maria Walpole, illegitimate granddaughter of our old mate Robert Walpole. That will bring in the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which gives the king the right to veto on any royal marriage. Well, there has to be an exception for princesses who are now part of a foreign country. We can't kind of have much control over them. There will be the occasional naughty royal who would just ignore the act. And just in case you're wondering, Edward VIII ensured that he was exempt from the act as part of his abdication to marry Wallis Simpson. Now, if we fast forward to 2011, PM David Cameron will propose that the act only apply to the first six units in the succession and not the thousands and thousands of others. Back to the past. Charlotte totally supported the act. She is also into magic beliefs that royals are special and should be not mingling their special DNA with common smellies. The princes will be welcomed back to court in about a decade. Yeah, they're going to do about 10 years out and then they'll can come back with their common smelly wives. In the meantime, Charlotte is feeding George's fears of another war of the roses with brother against brother and the population picking a team. She'll also remind George that his great-grandma, Sophia Dorothea, had been a common smelly. She will then speak in public about her Charlotte DNA being superior to George's tainted DNA. Charlotte was also big on the protocol bullshit. Everybody's got to do it. Full formal court dress at all times, and Charlotte will not be into new fashion ideas. Trendy courtiers will push the envelope just to stick it up her. The big deal at the minute is feathers in the hair. Duchess of Devonshire will have feathers so tall she can only just fit through the door. And there's no sitting in Charlotte's presence without permission either. And then stay still unless Charlotte tells you you can move. No man except George may sit in her presence. No males are served refreshments if it's just Charlotte without George. Oh, God, Charlotte, come on, calm down. Charlotte is very proper, but not all queens were quite so proper. The queens hanging around at the time. George's sister, Caroline Matilda, Queen of Denmark, was banging Johan Struensee, who was the doctor to her husband, who's mad. Her husband, the king, mad. Yeah, another mad king. It will go okay for a bit. Caroline and Johan will run Denmark while the mad king went off to the brothels, and everybody was happy. In comes the mad king's stepmum, and Johan will find himself in the slammer, while Caroline can be in house arrest and die in 1775, aged just 23. Caroline had begged George to bring her home to England, but she got a no. We can't cope with a scandal is the problem. Yeah, we can't cope with it. Yeah, poor us. Let your sister die then, mate. Charlotte is also keeping up with the news from Mecklenburg. Her sister, of course, remains single, not being allowed to marry a lowly duke, but brother Prince Charles has married Princess Frederica of Hessen-Darmstadt, and they're a happy couple. Here comes a kitty for more happiness. Charles will visit England, and Charlotte will have a lovely time with her brother, much boo-hoo-hooing when he has to leave. Charlotte has Lady Charlotte Finch to help out with the kitties. Big governess, I should say, and Lady Charlotte is a top governess. We can see with her that Charlotte could be tough with the employees. Lady Charlotte will sadly report to Queen Charlotte that one of the staff has been on the boil during the working hours and so has been turfed out. Lady Charlotte will also recommend a replacement. Yeah, that's good. She should be able to recommend a replacement. Not for Queen Charlotte, who will put Lady Charlotte firmly back in a box. You've said that coming into the family, you felt some distress in not having appointed the sub-governess. This place is not to be disposed of by either the governor or governess, but us alone. Their recommendations are taken as well, and in preference to others, but choice and determination lies solely in us. Yeah. Lady Charlotte had her own problems. Yeah, she's got a husband, but there you go. Point is, she will have to ask for 2 days off a week. Oh my God, lazy bloody workers wanting 2 days off a week. Lady Charlotte wasn't on fixed hours, with the deal being she had to work at least 6 hours in the day and then evenings as the Queen dictated. Queen Charlotte might have been firm in who gets the jobs, but in this case she will say, yeah, okay.
The request for a couple of days off a week looks pretty reasonable, but Charlotte will then ask her to put in more hours on the 5 days that she's there. Lady Charlotte was great for the education of the young royals, and the girls got pretty much the same education as the boys. There was a difference, though. The boys had disciplined lessons, all nice and austere. The Lady Charlotte was loved by the princesses, who called her Lady Char. Lady Charlotte embraced a new idea that mothers encourage and be involved in kiddies' education. Yeah, it's a new thing. Queen Charlotte will be on board with that, and mothers being involved in education has been helped to grow, and it turned out to be a very good thing. As the kiddies grow, the princesses will go to Lady Charlotte's home in Kew, and the princes will see less and less of her. Lady Charlotte will live to 88, although her hearing won't last that long. Yes, he walks like an ace now, and we will have fun till Daddy takes the T-Bird away. But we've got to get back to George, and in 1770 we will see a rallying of support. Bute's influence on George is gone, and people think that's a good thing. Thoughts of something like Willie the Duke of Cumberland taking over the big chair, also gone. George has got plenty of heirs. The Jacobite thingy is just a memory for old boys. The Tories have been restored into the political mainstream, which has caused a bit of instability, and plenty of parliamentarians see the need to calm all that shit down. The opposition have been getting a bit extreme, but unlike now, we've got plenty of parliamentarians that see the need to calm that stuff down as well. The opposition are divided, which helps to rally the rest. And George may actually have learned a thing or two about politics. Because there are no other candidates for the big chair, some of our English are looking at the Republic ideas, but there won't be that many at all. Surely a Republic would be worse than a monarchy, is the thinking. We did leave George once again in need of a Prime Minister. Augustus Fitzroy, Duke of Grafton, had given it away on the 28th of January 1770, so come on down, Frederick North, Earl of Guildford. His reputation will be a bit all over the place, but he will be sticking with the PM gig for quite a while. This guy isn't actually the Earl yet. His dad's going to live a long time, so he won't get the Earl thingy for another 20 years or so yet. Even so, we give him the courtesy title of Lord North. He is 6 years older than George and an astute politician. Not being the Earl right now meant he can hang out in the House of Commons, and he's become the Leader of the House. That job is a bit easier than Leader of the House of Lords. You know, the Lords all think that they're the big swinging dicks, so, yeah, trying to herd them is a bit difficult. Like the previous successful PMs, Robert Walpole and Henry Pelham, Lord North has experience in the Treasury. George certainly knew the guy. He had spoken, that is, North had spoken against that John Wilkes, the journalist who had been bagging George. He also led the motion to have Wilkes booted out of the House of Commons. So a fan of the King, but not perhaps a fan of democracy. You can do better being a fan of the King rather than a fan of democracy. So when August Fitzroy, Duke Grafton, declared he'd had enough, George offered the top job to Freddie North. Well, more told North he was Prime Minister rather than offer the job. Just, yeah, you're it, North. At least there was a nice easy transition, as North had been doing more and more of the work as Augustus found out that he wasn't up to the job. The opposition will be shitty, as oppositions are, and the government's majority in the House will drop, but North will still have a majority of 54 votes to play with. George has no trouble with morale, saying all we need to do is show some spirit and the majority will surely rise. The predictions, though, are that the North government will fall. It won't. He will consolidate his position while the opposition go for the good old squabble amongst themselves. Former PM George Grenville will die and North will pick up more supporters there. Oh, here's trouble over the Falkland Islands, which the Poms for some reason always want. Fuck if I know why they want them, but they do. Spain will say, hey, they are ours. Argentina in our time, of course. Well, I say our time, my time. I guess I'm getting old. It was Margaret Thatcher's war, wasn't it? The Falkland Islands. The Falkland Islands are a bloody long way from Britain. They're right down the southern part of South America. But still, the Poms want them. The Frenchies in our time, or our podcast time. God, I'm getting myself bloody in a muddle, aren't I? Let me try that again. The Frenchies in podcast time had recently given their claim on the Falklands to Spain. Now, hang on, says Britain. North, like George, was keen to avoid stupid foreign wars. The policy then will be send gunships so the Spanish can see our naval power and we'll speak firmly to the filthy Dagos. There's even a quote from George. Every feeling of humanity as well as the knowledge of the distress war must occasion makes me desirous of preventing it, if it can be accomplished, provided the honour of the country is preserved. Lovely stuff, and wouldn't it be nice to see a bit of that attitude in our time? In bloody Israel and Gaza and bloody Ukraine and Russia, and can't we all just see what George is saying there? War just causes lots and lots of distress, so why not try and prevent it? The Spanish will back down so the crisis can be avoided and we won't have a stupid foreign war. It's a nice win for North, and his win will allow him to pop in some policies for Ireland and America. That's like a nice temporary band-aid on those two places. Meantime, we're all forgetting about Wilkes and his particular political crisis. We'd had those by-elections, and the House of Commons had said that Wilkes, who scored 1,143 votes, lost to Luttrell, who got 296 votes. Yeah, most of us can't see that, House of Commons. Middlesex sent their petition that Luttrell could not sit as their representative without manifest infringement on their rights and privileges. What have the Commons got in response to that? Those who obstinately and willfully persevere in voting for an unqualified person are to be considered as not voting at all. Oh, okay. So I guess that what they're saying in this case is that Wilkes had earlier been declared an outlaw, with Parliament saying he's not allowed to be in government, so they expelled Wilkes. And that means that he's not eligible. So if you vote for him, you're voting for somebody who's ineligible. That's what the House is saying. Anyway, like everything, time will help this thing become just a memory, and North was seen as being a big helper in resolving it and making it go away. George is still unpopular with the mob. No cheering and waving when he's out and about. No, he gets hissing. 1771, an apple is thrown at his coach, oh dear. But it isn't necessarily the same if he's outside of London. So let's send him off to Portsmouth to look at some big manly ships and plenty of cheering and waving and singing God Save the King, and George is so moved with the common smelly reception that he's singing along and weeping tears of joy. Oh, isn't it marvellous? It's the same when he's with the big dicks of the town. He's affable and charming and he's got manly questions and they're sensible and pertinent and he's taking notes. And he's got discretion and propriety, and he's here for real instruction, not just to amuse himself. This trip to Portsmouth has gone so well, there'll be a play. What do we call the play? The trip to Portsmouth. Okay. Yeah, great. There you go, although there might be something here that we should note. Portsmouth was almost entirely dependent on the government for its income. It's the place where we like to keep, build, fit, and whatever, our navy. Lots of people were directly dependent on the Crown for their job, so when George visited, it was like the King and your CEO of your employer all rolled into one. Still, all this happiness now means that George won't mind a bit of touring. That then will lead to more support for the government, and that will show up in the polls with the increasing majorities in the elections. The trouble, as usual, is inside Parliament. The followers of Rockingham are talking up a royal conspiracy about paedophiles operating out of a pizza parlour. No, hang on. They're talking about a royal conspiracy about an attack on liberty. And, look, it's getting paranoid, really. That's why I said the thing about paedophiles and a pizza parlour. When we talk about attacks on liberty, we're getting a bit paranoid. And the paranoid thought is being picked up in America. The number of people involved seems to be very small, but they're very, very loud. And that's always the same. A small group of loud people dominating the discussion, with the majority of their larger group recognising that whatever negative bullshit these people are on about is not really a basis for government. Back in the day, it was even harder because they didn't have party discipline at all. There was none. So you get lots of groups of people, and no one of them is large enough to dominate the commons. You need to try and impress the other groups, and paranoia won't do that. North was not much of a party man at all. He'll rely on royal backing and the support of a whole lot of independent MPs. That isn't terribly stable, but hey, nothing has worked so far for George. North's dad had been George's governor for a couple of years, and both guys are devout Anglicans. Those things help, and hell, here's a Gartonite thingy for North. George will also pay out North's debts of £20,000, and yeah, that does seem to make the PM beholden to the King. North in the future will also score the Warden of the Cinque Ports, and yeah, it also seems to make the PM beholden to the King. George will perhaps be overly interested in Parliament. He wants North to win over certain guys. He wants very regular reports on what's going on and who is saying what. He wants the division figures in the voting. George was against Parliament's actions on the press. Now, this time, Parliament kept the right to publish its proceedings. Only Parliament could do it. It issued, like its own newspapers, about what was going on in Parliament, telling private newspapers to stay out. But private newspapers didn't want to stay out, causing the Commons to take action against private newspapers, which published government stuff. The City of London, though, will protect the publishers, and so we're going to have a clash between the City and the Parliament. The Commons will win, but it's not a good win. We can see that this sort of stuff will suppress debate, so pretty much Parliament will end up just not taking any more action against the press. That, then, is when George will be against Parliament's actions, or lack of actions, against the press. He thinks publishers should be brought to the House of Lords, which can not only fine people, they can imprison people. He is a bit extreme, and that will perhaps be his policy with America. Now, George is getting on well with North, and North is having some success. But North is also a self-doubter, which is not handy in a leader. He is indecisive, and that means he can't impose himself on Parliament. George will remain also very interested in foreign policy. He had done some sucking up to the Frenchies to end the 7 Years' War as soon as he could. Since then, he has looked to be friendly and helpful, but by 1771, we can see he is against France. Here's what he wrote. My political creed is formed on the system of King William, that's old William of Orange. England, in conjunction with the House of Austria, that's the Empire, and the Republic, that's the Duchies, seem the most secure barrier against the family compact. Now that is the alliance of Bourbon monarchies of France and Spain. And if Russia could be added to this, I think the court of Versailles would not be in a hurry to commence hostilities. But this plan may be difficult to be effected, though I'm sure it is in the real interest of the four states. Yeah, so he's got a good plan. He wants to get together with the Empire and the Duchies and Russia and form a team there to be the balance against Spain and France. George still has an eye on the piggy bank. That's a problem. The Swedes are available for an alliance in return for cash, but George doesn't want to spend. Meanwhile, the Frenchies are saying, hey, George, have you seen Russian Catherine going crazy taking stuff? we need to be careful and perhaps team up against Catherine. What the Frenchies were talking about at that stage was Poland, which is kind of gone. Yeah, Catherine sort of got it. She's banging the king. Fred the Great wanted to stop the empire. That's the Holy Sausage Empire, which I need to clarify because with Catherine the Great in Russia, Russia's also an empire. Yeah, we've got two empires now. Anyway, Fred the Great saw that the sausages wanted to take Poland to stop Catherine from taking it. Fred then said, hey, why don't we cut this particular cake into three and we can each have a bit. So Fred will score 36,000 kilometres and 580,000 poles. The sausages will get 83,000 kilometres and 2.6 million poles, leaving for Catherine 92,000 square kilometres and 1.3 million poles. Lovely, and we'll all be happy, except maybe the poles, but who gives a fuck about them? And I wasn't kidding about cutting up the cake. It's from a Frenchy satire about this very thing. The Trolf Cake, or the Twelfth Cake, or the Royal Cake, or the Cake of Kings, depending on your version of the picture, which went with a satire. Yeah, satire and pictures of the cake being cut up. The former King of Poland had just been a puffer to Catherine, really, and she was probably banging him, but it all went pear-shaped for him when he wanted to do a bit of ruling on his own without Catherine. Yeah, she didn't like that. The point for us is that Frenchies can see these big three swinging dicks, and sure, Catherine might have the biggest dick out of the three, but these three have just had a country for lunch and are big and powerful, so they want to be our friends. George, though, is in arm-in-arm mode, so no deal just yet. Oh, George, maybe you should hop in there. Okay. Wishy-washy phase over, so George will talk it up with the Earl of Rochford, who is one of our two secretaries of state and a friend of the king. William, the Earl of Rochford, likes it, so George will change his mind. Oh, shit, George. Now, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, so let's try to not. You've got this guy, Gustav III, King of Sweden, who has really had problems with royal authority. He, though, has now just staged a bloodless coup, so he's in power, and the first thing he did was a deal with France. George then is now suspicious of France. He also thinks that an Anglo-Frenchy alliance wouldn't be enough if the two empires and Fred the Great teamed up against them. George also thinks that the two empires and Fred won't last. They'll break up. Lastly, he thinks Louis XV is getting pretty old and is sure to die, so French policy will probably change. As for that last bit, well, yeah, we might as well bump off Louis XV, so that'll be 1774, and 15 is dead. Second longest serving king of France, great-grandson of Louis XIV. Now, 15, his eldest lad has also died, so it'll be his grandson, Louis, who will be 16, the King of France, along with his missus, Marie Antoinette. Anyway, 15 became king age 5 and died age 65, so sort of 60 years on the big chair. Believe it or not, 16 will have a go at some really good stuff. But I'm getting ahead of myself once again. Right now then, we are not up for a deal with the Frenchies. Okay, at least we know that, fair enough. The team of George and North are going rather well. These guys are both peacetime leaders and will go okay, so long as a stupid bloody foreign war doesn't break out. If only North knew how to keep the colonials in America happy. Sadly, he doesn't. Now, hang on, I've gone off a bit early there. I wanted to tell you that George is a hard worker. Who cares? Not me. Look, he's a hard worker. He reads lots of reports. Does that help anybody? Now, for me, hard workers are guys who might be into a bit of micromanagement or don't know how to delegate. And, oh, look, poor me. However, will I get all this work done? Well, look, if there's genuinely too much work for you to handle, then you get an offsider. More likely, though, you're spending your time on nonsense. Anyway, having bagged George for being a hard worker, I want to draw your attention to paintings he commissioned for the warm room at Buckingham Palace. Well, one painting in particular, which portrays the Roman consul and dickhead Regulus. If I was ever to commission a painting, then the departure of Regulus from Rome would be about the last thing I would want in that painting. Yeah, I'd rather have dogs playing poker, thank you. So Regulus and his co-consul were in that big old First Punic War against Carthage, where the Romans did a bit of teach-yourself naval warfare and belted up the very experienced Carthaginian navy. Regulus was already a hero before that, having belted up the Salentini tribe to capture Brindisium, giving Rome a handy port on the Adriatic Sea. Yeah, the Romans were very impressed there, and he got a triumph for it. So, okay, let's get Regulus and his co-consul back off to sea, off the coast of Sicily to build up the Carthaginian navy, then off to Carthage for some more belting. The co-consul will be back to Rome, leaving Regulus to defeat Carthage. In he goes to negotiate a peace, and the story goes that his terms were extremely harsh, way too harsh for the Carthaginians to accept, and so it was no thanks from Carthage. Now, in reality, the terms were probably just something like, you guys get out of Sicily because that's what we want. Carthage would have said no to that anyway. In come some Spartan mercenaries who were totally outraged about the very harsh terms that Regulus offered. Yeah, right, they're here for the money. What an arsehole, they say. Let us help you defeat this great big turd. And defeat him they will. Regulus will be captured, and the Carthaginians will send him back to Rome to get a deal for a prisoner exchange. Regulus will get to Rome and make a stirring speech. We can't negotiate with terrorists or some such bullshit, and so we must tell the Carthaginians to stick their prisoner swap where the sun don't shine. As for me, well, I made a very sacred oath on our very real gods, who are the best gods, by the way, everybody says that. So I made a sacred oath that I would return to Carthage, and return I will, to tell them face to stick their prisoner swap where the sun don't shine, and of course that means I shall be tortured to death. No, don't cry. Being tortured to death is all in a day's work for a consul of Rome, the greatest whatever in the history of whenever. In the 21st century, my dear listener, our historians can call bullshit on Livy's story. Just a bit of ancient propaganda. But for George, it was all very real. The question is, what does this tell us about this mad bugger? Yeah, that's better. Just a little bit of Richie Blackmore there to get us into some historical fiction. Strange Kind of Woman, live album made in Japan. Yeah, Deep Purple. In case you hadn't worked it out. Okay, historical fiction. And I did have a crack at Queen Charlotte A. Bridgerton's story. Bloody fairy tale. And okay, I've gotten used to some of the modern ideas like having black actors portraying real-life historical white people, even though we can't do it the other way. I did note that. We can't do it the other way. That's okay. And, of course, we have to have a couple of gay characters in there kissing and getting it on because it's the 21st century. But, really, now they're changing the narrative so that these people are trying to tackle bloody racism in the 18th century. And, no, it's just not on. It's just not on. Charlotte herself is just nothing like the historical Charlotte that we're meeting. Our historical Charlotte is into duty and yada blah, yada blah. There's no story about the king was living up the road at Kew and dumping Charlotte in Buckingham Palace. He gave her Buckingham Palace, but it was a couple of years after they were married. She knocked out some good, healthy air boys before she got Buckingham Palace, mate. So it's just too off the planet for me, I'm afraid, the Charlotte thing. I wasn't able to watch more than two episodes. But if you enjoy it, good for you, my dear listener. I just can't support it. Now, in the interests of fairness, I will declare to you that if you go back 15 generations, yes, that is 15, then apparently Charlotte was descended from one Madragonara or something like that, who was some floozy that King Alfonso III of Portugal banged. And Madraganana was allegedly dark-skinned. There you go. That's where they get this black woman from. But it's 15 generations earlier. We're back in the early 13th century. So, yeah, it's a bit slim. But it's just a matter of what we go out with. And there's some guys from down the road from me call themselves the Chats. And they wrote a song protesting about Smoko, which was a bit stupid because Smoko is it's a sacred thing in Australia. I suppose it can be annoying if you're on the other end of it. Heads up, we'll have a crack at their song, The Chats and Smoko. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
1, 2, 3, 4. Degrees.